to East Meets West. I'm Olga Botaman.
I'm Tara Reid, and we have a very special guest. He needs no introduction. He's probably one of the most famous journalists in the world and a really good human being all around. Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson, thank you so much for being with us. We are honored, and it's such a pleasure to see you.
So happy to have you with us.
Yeah. Oh.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I'm sorry, as I was saying off camera, I just got out of the banya. I'm a little sweaty, so pardon my appearance, but I'm really happy to be here.
That's
so
wonderful.
You also love banya, as Russians do, right?
I love banya every single day. I don't miss a day. And if I miss a day, I get sick. That's why
wow.
I do it.
That's really very, very healthy.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with the news. And we all know that in June, you left the Republican Party after spending 35 years in it. And as we all know, you're very close to President Trump. There was even some discussion about him nominating you to be the vice president. And you were called the mouthpiece of the MAGA movement. And still, you quit over the war in Iran. So can I please ask you, what was that? Was it Trump that changed dramatically in his second term? Or was it you who finally took off the so-called rose-colored glasses?
Well, probably both. But from my perspective now, I mean, it will be years, if not in this life, that I understand exactly what happened. I don't fully understand what happened. But Donald Trump ran against exactly what he's doing now, which was one of the main reasons I supported him for 10 years. And in February of this year, the 28th, he did precisely what he said he would never do. And he did it at the behest of Israel, a foreign country. And it's not an attack on Israel to say the United States should have sovereignty. Our leaders should make decisions on the basis of what's good for their people, not on the basis of what's good for some foreign country. Mm-hmm. So Trump got into this war because he was pushed by Israel. I saw that happen. I'm not guessing. That's not anti-Semitism. It's a fact. And I was disgusted by it, as I think most Americans were. And so I couldn't participate anymore. And I like Trump. It's nothing personal. I've always liked Trump. I get along with him. I think he's smart. I think he's interesting. He's very funny. There's a lot about him that I will always like. But this is immoral. It's terrible for the United States. It's bad for the world, but it's terrible for the United States. It's dangerous. And I think that's become very obvious over the last 4 months. So that's why I left, and the Republican Party supported it. Not simply the war, but this kind of subordinate position to Israel. And anyone who questioned that was attacked as an anti-Semite, which I am not. And I'm simply an American who thinks that the American government should serve the American people. But the Republican Party, almost every single member of the Republican Party has decided that the interest of Israel is more important than the interest of the United States. There are a couple of exceptions, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Thomas Massie, and they were driven out of the Republican Party. So it tells you what the priority is. The priority is serving Israel. And even if I liked Israel, which I do not, because it's committing genocide, but even if I liked Israel, I would think this was immoral. I wouldn't want the United States government serving the interests of Russia or Great Britain or Sweden, where my family's from. I mean, it's immoral. It's always immoral, no matter what country is controlling your country. I think we deserve sovereignty. So it's really that simple.
Tucker, but from what I know, you met President Trump and you tried to dissuade him from attacking Iran. So can you throw some light on how this conversation went? What was his reply to your arguments? And generally, is he the person who listens to someone's advice?
Well, I do think Trump listens to other people. And I think Trump, you know, has obvious flaws and they're all on display now. But you know, he was elected president twice in a very difficult environment. He has enormous talent and he's smart. And anyone who says he's senile or can't think clearly doesn't know him. He's not senile and he does think clearly. I spoke to him many times, not just once. I went to the White House three times in the weeks before the war. I spoke to him by phone many times. I made the case continuously. This is a bad idea. It's terrible for the United States. It's terrible for you. And the Republican Party, your legacy will be destroyed if you do this. Israel is pushing you to do this, not because of Iran's nuclear program, but because Israel wants control of the Middle East. Israel wants the United States out of the Middle East. It wants to destroy the Gulf states. and it wants to break Iran into pieces, and it wants Iran consumed by civil war. This is all true and obvious. And I said this to Trump. This is not about the nuclear program, which, by the way, you said you destroyed back in June.
Right.
I didn't think there was a nuclear program. That's what you told me. But this is about Israel's attempt to establish regional hegemony, of course. And I'm not even judging Israel. All countries want, big countries with nuclear weapons want regional hegemony. Russia wants it. Russia doesn't want Moldova going crazy and joining NATO. I understand that. The United States wants it. We don't want Mexico to host Chinese missiles. I mean, these are not crazy things. It's why
Cuba.
The war in Ukraine broke out. Or Cuba, exactly. Russia didn't want NATO missiles on its western border. Why would it? So these are not crazy ideas. These are normal ideas. And Israel wants to control the Middle East. And it wants, again, Iran destroyed in civil war. It wants the Gulf states, the six GCC countries, which are very powerful because they're very rich. It wants them diminished. And it wants the U.S. out. And I said this to him. And he said, I know. So it's like, because he's not stupid. And he understands power. And he understands other people's instincts and goals. And so he knew perfectly well, and he did it anyway. So the question is why? And I don't know.
You know, you brought up about Iran, I mean, with the war in Iran and trying to stop that. And then you had right now a vote that is happening today, actually, for the NDAA, which is the National Defense Authorization Act. It's 1,000 pages long, and in there is 219 is the IDF, Israel's army, being merged with the United States military. But what hasn't been talked about is it's also intelligence. So the intelligence community and the Pentagon. And we had a guest who was a former CIA analyst, and she said, look, I don't think people understand that once this is entangled and merged, you can't untangle it. So Tom Massey has been sounding the alarm, Marjorie Taylor Greene, you've been sounding the alarm, other people have, but otherwise it's just kind of slipping through. What are you hearing now on the ground? Because today is kind of the day where America loses its sovereignty.
Well, I think America lost its sovereignty many years ago. I mean, CIA and Mossad have worked together, in some cases really as one, for over 60 years. I mean, there are two monuments to James Jesus Angleton, the former counterintelligence chief at CIA, in Jerusalem. Well, why is that? That'd be interesting to find out. But Mossad and CIA have worked, and I'm not guessing about this, have worked together very, very closely for a long time. And of course, Mossad has fed repeatedly disinformation lies to American policymakers over decades, including the lie that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. That fundamentally came from Israel. There's no dispute about that. The lie that killing the Ayatollah, the Shiite Pope, would lead to the collapse of the Iranian government. No American intelligence agency said that. Mossad said that. And Netanyahu told Trump that. So there's a long track record of the United States, its people, its 350 million people, being misused by Israeli intelligence. And so the idea that you would merge them formally is a generational disaster. It's also humiliating, of course. It says to the people of the United States, you have no control over your own country. You were told this is yours. You run it. You own it. You're a shareholder in this enterprise.
Isn't it a form of treason?
And so, well, it's the definition of treason. It's the definition. This is treason. This is acting against your own nation on behalf of a foreign nation. But, of course, there's a lot of that here and has been for quite some time. I mean, we can't get the Kennedy assassination documents declassified, right. Thousands of them. Why is that? Is it because the U.S. government is protecting the CIA? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. We can't get the 9/11 documents declassified 25 years later. 3,000 Americans died. Why is that? I mean, right. So this is a longstanding problem, but it is a lot of Americans are waking up to the fact it's not a minor problem. It's not an ancillary problem. It's not just something we should fix in the future. It is the problem that led us into a war that's ending American empire and going to cause massive economic disruption here and in Europe. So the idea that the Republican Party would support a merger of U.S. and Israeli intelligence, IDF and Pentagon, is so deranged that, you know, you have to root for treason trials, for Nuremberg trials at some point. Will it pass? Now, I heard last night, I should be totally honest about this. Not everyone in the White House is for this. And the president could veto it. He won't because he's a slave to Israel. But there are others in the White House who are very opposed to this. Okay, there are normal, non-crazy people serving in the U.S. government, a lot of them. And I heard last night that this is not going to pass. I pray that that's true because it's, as your guest said correctly, it's impossible to undo this once it's done.
Yes, it's very concerning. And Charlie Kirk was sounding the alarm about Israel. I was on his show twice. I didn't know him personally as much as you did. He was very kind to me. You were one of the few journalists that actually had me on your show, you and Megyn Kelly, and Glenn Greenwald stood up for me a bit. And Charlie Kirk had me on his show twice, and one of his last texts to me was, "Tara, I'm praying for you." And he was such a good man. And it was so horrifying to see him executed in public, the way that happened. He was standing up, according to a lot of people close to him, that was verified. And I wanted your thoughts about what's happening with that investigation or lack thereof right now.
I'll be honest and say I find the whole subject so upsetting that I have averted my gaze. I've tried not to follow it. Okay. I know everyone involved, of course. I knew Charlie very well. He was a friend of mine. I've said, and I probably shouldn't have said, but I have said, that in America, we seem to have a lot of lone gunmen who, you know, shoot people who challenge power. And that's a little weird, but very weird, from Malcolm X to John F. Kennedy to Charlie Kirk. I'll just be blunt with you. I'm resigned to not ever knowing the truth because I live in a country where the president of the United States was assassinated in public in Dallas next to his wife. The governor of Texas was shot right next to him. And we can't even get the files declassified 63 years later. So that really kind of tells you how things work here. When you really push hard, the answer is no, you're not allowed to know. And why is that? Well, you know, kind of explains itself, I think. So I don't think we're ever going to get a straight answer. Did Tyler Robinson shoot him? Seems like it. I don't know. That's not the question. The question is, did he have help? And what was the motive of the people who may have helped him? And no one seems to be asking that question, which is the question as far as I'm concerned. Just logically, just as a journalist, someone approaching this empirically, it's like, that's the question. It's the question about Thomas Crooks in the Butler shooting. And of course, you can't get an answer. And it's infuriating. Now, unlike a lot of countries, Russia, for example, the United States has a 200-year history of telling its people, you have a right to know what your government is doing. We don't have a tradition of secrecy. We have, in effect, centuries of secrecy, but we tell our population, no, these are your documents. You own them. You have a right to know. And then we withhold them. So it drives people crazy. It drives me a little crazy. In fact, it drives me so crazy that I've decided I'm just not going to think about it if I can help it, because it really makes me mad.
Tucker, if I can get back to Israel and Iran, we've seen public quarrels recently between Trump and Netanyahu. And some experts say that it may be like a staged theater play, while the others think that Trump is actually mad about Netanyahu since he cannot control him at all, militarily as well. So what do you think of that? And also, how desperate do you think is Trump now regarding the war in Iran? Can he go for a ground invasion or a nuclear attack that he already threatened?
Thank you for noticing the threat of a nuclear attack. You know, most Americans have no idea that happened. It happened on Truth Social at least once. Wow. And it, I think on camera as well. And our media just didn't cover it. President of the United States threatening to unleash nuclear weapons on a foreign country. Like, what? So that was a huge moment in the life and history of our country, and it was totally ignored by our media. I think Trump is genuinely mad at Netanyahu. I don't think he likes Netanyahu. I don't think anyone likes Netanyahu personally. I don't think Mrs. Netanyahu likes Netanyahu. Nobody likes Netanyahu. And I've said to Trump repeatedly, Netanyahu is your enemy. He doesn't like you. By the way, he sided with Joe Biden after the 2020 election. So, like, this is not your friend. I've told him that. And Trump says, well, I don't have any friends. Okay. But beware of your enemies would be my advice, and was my advice to him. Trump knew within days of the war breaking out that the Israeli intelligence he'd received and apparently believed or forced himself to believe or whatever happened, that it was false. They killed the Ayatollah, one of the craziest things America's ever done. We don't murder other people's religious leaders. And 85-year-old men and their families. Like, that's insane. That's crazy behavior, because it, well, first of all, it's immoral. You shouldn't kill non-combatants. You shouldn't kill other people's, like, we've always had, I mean, you think Putin couldn't kill Zelensky? Probably could. Hasn't. Why? Because we don't kill leaders like that. Because it ends the possibility of a negotiated settlement. You can't have diplomacy when you kill people's leaders. And we hold out the possibility of diplomacy because we don't want war if we can help it. Normal people don't. Humane Christian people don't want that. So it was a crazy thing to do. And we did it. Trump did it. And he was convinced that the government would fall, and it didn't. And he was very mad. He blamed Netanyahu correctly. Well, he should blame himself, but he blamed Netanyahu. And so I think it's absolutely real that he's mad at Netanyahu, very frustrated. J.D. Vance has been very frustrated and said so. But does it matter? I mean, look, who's in charge? Like, we know who's in charge by what happens when Trump signs a memorandum of understanding with Iran and says, you know, we're going to stop the hostilities in Lebanon, and then doesn't. Can't seem to get Netanyahu to stop murdering civilians in Lebanon, the only country in the Middle East with a Christian president, then you know who's in charge, and it's not Trump.
Tucker, if I can get back to your withdrawal from the Republican Party, you also said during your previous interview that you were not even thinking of joining the Democratic Party. So, because it seems there is that neither of two major parties actually cares about its citizens, the U.S. citizens. So, in one of your interviews, you said that you would like to help create a third party. Could you throw some light on what could this party be? Who could join this party? Would it also include the left peace activists? So, and the most important question is, could this third party, you already have a number of third parties in the United States, so could this third party be viable in the system where it is the big sponsors' money that actually stand behind the outcome?
Well, it of course it couldn't be right now. Things would have to change. We've never had a really meaningful third party. And for most of my life, I felt that we didn't need one because we had an option. You could vote Republican, you could vote Democrat, they're very different. And what I've realized with age, I'm 57, and watching very carefully and knowing the people who run the parties, is that on the big questions, the ones that really matter, economics and foreign policy, who gets rich, who do we bomb, the parties are in total alignment. They don't disagree at all. They disagree over trans rights or something. Okay. But on the big questions, Chuck Schumer and now Donald Trump are on the same page. They have the same views. So Americans don't have an option. Now, from my perspective, the Democratic Party is not acceptable because it's anti-Christian and it's anti-white, aggressively anti-Christian and even more aggressively anti-white. That's why they hate Russia, obviously. And I think it's very clear to you in Russia, they hate you not because they hate you, because you're a white Christian country. Okay, that's truly what they dislike most. Why is that? I don't know, but it's obvious. So I'm never going to be associated with a party like that. That's evil. But I think Americans need an option. And they don't have one. And I think it's very clear. What do I want to see? You know, I want to see people who love their country, happy to debate how to fix the country. It's complicated. I don't have all the answers. But you have to begin with a gut-level love for your country, for your people. And our people are not thriving at all, by every measure. So somebody has to care about them much more than he cares about campaign contributions or his friends in the cryptocurrency industry or Miriam Adelson or Bibi Netanyahu. It's like, I'm not even against that. I'm not attacking those people. I'm merely saying the president has to feel about his people the way a father feels about his children. It has to be rooted in love and sacrifice for them. And we just don't have that. So I want to have that very much.
You know, it's interesting because you've been seeing Hunter Biden on some sort of redemption tour on podcasts. He was on Candace Owens' podcast about a week before she came from Moscow, and I watched it very closely, and she didn't ask him about his money laundering or the Biden corruption. He claimed that Joe Biden would be against this war, blah, blah, blah. Joe Biden was a Zionist and self-proclaimed. There's videotape of him declaring himself a Zionist and taking money from AIPAC and whatnot. So there's that. But Hunter Biden then went on to go on a podcast with Gavin Newsom, and they were joking that they would make a ticket. So I'm not going to bore you with asking you if you're going to run for president, because I've heard, you know, you've already said no, but that you weren't interested in that.
No.
Yeah, but what would prompt you to want to somehow be involved, especially hearing if it's a ticket like Gavin Newsom and Hunter Biden or something like that, or let's say the Democrats are winning in the midterms and there's some momentum. What could propel an alternative to what's happening? And is J.D. Vance even viable?
You know, I don't know. And I have a long and shameful track record of calling everything about American politics wrong. Like, I campaigned for Trump. I spoke at the Republican National Convention in July of 2024. I had no idea. So that shows you how wise I am about politics. Not very. I don't understand it very well. I've been around it my whole life. I worked as an intern in the Senate in 1986, 40 years ago, and I've never figured it out. I don't have a gut level feeling for it. I don't know why, but I don't. So I don't, I honestly, I don't know. I can say that Gavin Newsom is a sociopath and technically defined. He will say anything and he will lie. He will tell a lie that you know is a lie.
Yeah.
And I doubt his blood pressure rises as he does it. And so that's scary to me. I don't see Hunter Biden that way for all of his faults. I see Hunter Biden as a man who was broken in public and humiliated. That's the beginning of wisdom from my perspective, having been an alcoholic. You know, I have a little bit of feeling for that. So I would definitely trust a man like that more than I would trust Gavin Newsom, who's had all kinds of problems in his life and never admitted any of them, lied about them, is a very disordered person. By the way, I know Gavin Newsom is a very charming person.
Yes.
Not stupid at all, but scary. People like that are scary. You know, you catch them doing something and they say, I'm not doing it, you are. You know, people like that should not have power.
Well, I mean, in American politics, the people like that are picked because they're compromised, and they're compromised enough to
yes,
where they can be controlled.
That's correct.
Right? So yeah. You know, someone like you is not going to be controlled. And I think the reason why people were excited about Trump, I even wrote an essay about that got published about Trump being maybe the hope to stop the endless wars. Boy, was I wrong. And I'm not good at predicting either. But they get in office, they lie, and then they get in office, and it's something different. So someone else is pulling the strings. Who's pulling the strings?
Do you know? I don't know. You know, one thing that I was really struck by reading parts of the Epstein files. Of course, mm-hmm. I didn't read the whole thing, but I read enough to satisfy my curiosity about one question, which is like, what was Jeffrey Epstein like? And when you read someone's own writing, his own emails, dashed off without thinking. So I was an editor for years, so I know that people's writing reveals them. Mm-hmm. And Jeffrey Epstein was like kind of a mediocre guy, not a genius at all. Sort of an ordinary person, actually. Clearly a ruthless person, an amoral person, but not any kind of string puller. He was an employee of something bigger. Now, what was that? Well, I think the obvious answer is that money, of course, is power. And so the biggest pools of capital make the most important decisions about the world because they are, if you think of this in business terms, the biggest shareholders in the enterprise. And so I think it's fair to understand the world that way. I don't know that there's a shadowy ethnic conspiracy. I think there is quite out in the open a governance by oligarchs. And I don't know that any civilization has ever been very different from that. And now in a healthy civilization, like in a monarchy, for example, the king is the richest guy. And so he has both the blessing of God and the capital. So he can make sovereign decisions. That's why he's called the sovereign. In a democracy, you know, you imagine that the majority make the decisions. But a democracy can't function, we're learning, without a majority middle-class population. So the second the United States became minority middle class in 2015 under Obama in his second term, which no one even noticed it happened, democracy became impossible because the richest people, all of a sudden you had this incredibly lopsided pyramid-shaped economy where all the money was going to the top 0.1%. Well, of course, they had not only the majority of the money, but the majority of the political power. And that's not democracy. And we're sort of figuring that out now. And you hear, you know, we need campaign finance reform. Oh, we're way beyond that. So I don't really know. I mean, one thing that I have always admired about Vladimir Putin and continue to admire, and I hope it's, you know, replicated across the world, is that he tamed the oligarchy to some extent. So the Soviet Union, this is my American view of Russia, just looking from afar. Soviet Union falls, small number of people grab a lot of the resources, mm-hmm. become incredibly rich. And because they are literally oligarchs, they have undue political influence. And Putin says, no, we're not doing that. Just because you're a billionaire, you own all the bauxite or whatever, doesn't mean you get to run the government. And he kicked them out, most of them. Yeah. And therefore, thereby reclaimed Russia. It's not a perfect democracy, of course. I'm not saying, I'm not here to promote Russia, but that was really important. Yeah. And that's, by the way, the reason those oligarchs have been funding the campaign against Putin ever since, as you well know. Most Americans mm-hmm. have no idea. But we need to do something like that. Just reclaim the political system for the people.
Tucker, since you touched Russia, can I shift gears a little bit and ask you about this narrative that is circulating in the Western media about Russia, as they say, preparing for a war with Europe by the year of 2030, which is pure insanity as for us. But what do you think? Who may benefit from these rumors? And is actually Europe going to fight Russia directly? Or are they trying maybe to boost, you know, their declining economies? Or what's going on?
I mean, the most absurd thing about that claim, 2030, is that I think it could happen by September of this year.
Oh.
I mean, Europe is funding a war against mainland Russia, against civilian infrastructure, against energy infrastructure. It's completely crazy that we have a global energy crisis. And the Europeans are sending long-range drones to destroy refineries in Russia? How do you think civilization functions with refined petroleum products, oil and gas? Every part of our civilization is dependent on fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. And if you don't think that, you're an idiot. You don't know math. You don't understand how the global economy works. There's a one-to-one correlation between the price of energy and your economy and GDP. It's one-to-one. So the cheaper the energy, the richer you are. The more expensive the energy, the poorer you are. It's literally that simple. And anyone who says it's not doesn't know what he's talking about. So Europe, which is on its way to poverty because they allowed the Americans to blow up Nord Stream, and because they backed this insane war with Iran, in which Iran took out a lot of Qatari LNG facilities, Europe is doomed to poverty, unfortunately. It's so sad. But Europe, rather than like facing that, has decided, you know, let's start a war with Russia. And, you know, you all are in Moscow. You work for RT. I mean, you have a much better sense of this than I do. But I talk to Russians, and I'm very concerned that there will be a Russian strike in retaliation for this stuff on Poland, Germany, UK. I mean, who knows? I think this is the most dangerous thing happening in the world right now. And the United States could end it tomorrow by saying, no, we're not going to allow this to continue because the CIA is not going to give the Ukrainian government the targeting information, which is what they use when they send missiles and drones into Russia. They use our targeting information. Right. And they use Starlink, which is supposedly an American company. So, like, we could end this. I don't know why we're not. We're not, because the neocon war lobby is pushing the administration to continue it. That's why. And this whole war is the result of the neocon war lobby, obviously. And they hate Russia and they hate Europe. And most Americans have no idea how much they hate Europe and how much they hate Russia. But I don't. And I think my civilization comes from Europe. I'm European American. My ancestors are from Europe. And Russia is one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. I'm not Russian. I'm not here to like promote Russia. But like, why would we want to destroy Russia or have a war with Russia? And to your question, can Europe beat Russia in a war? You know, it's a joke. It's absurd. They can't even field an army. And they shouldn't have to. We shouldn't have a war between Europe and Russia. And you have to ask, why would anyone want that? And the conventional, if you ask Russians, they say, well, because we have the world's deepest deposits of resources. They want our resources. They want to break up our country and steal our resources. Yeah, of course, that's part of it. I don't think that's the whole story. There's a spiritual component to this. Mm-hmm. They hate Russia because it's Christian. That's why. That's why they hate Europe. So let's just be honest. Let's stop lying here. Like, that is the driving motive. And I think Putin trying to re-Christianize Russia, he hasn't been very radical about it from what I can tell, but he's said, you know, we're going to rebuild churches and we're a Christian Orthodox country and with a big Muslim minority who we get along with, like that's 20% or something big to get along with them. That's extremely offensive to certain people, extremely. It's a threat. And that is the problem. And I honestly think if Putin had just left the oligarchs in place, okay, you get to secretly run the government like they do in the United States, and not tried to reintroduce Russian Orthodoxy into the life of the country, this war wouldn't have happened. I sincerely believe that, because I know the people are pushing it. And what they hate most is Christianity. And everyone is forced to lie about it. These are deranged, evil people, but we have to like pretend that they're like rational people. They're not rational people. This is spiritual. And I do think some Russians understand that. Do they?
Well, I'm not sure it's a religious, but it's definitely, the reason lies deeper. This hatred, this Russophobia.
Yes.
It definitely lies deeper than, you know, just Ukraine, definitely.
Yeah, you know, and on Russophobia, yeah, going to Russophobia, when I worked back in the U.S. Senate during the fall of the Soviet Union, I was there right around that time, they were talking openly that Russia would not be allowed a seat at the table. I remember listening to that in meetings and so on. And these were like not secretive meetings. They were like on documents and whatever, that how that Russophobia, and who was leading it was, you know, people like Biden, people like John Kerry, people like, and then those that came later, Clinton administration was very anti-Russia. I think, you know, and it only accelerated with Biden. And now you had Lindsey Graham, who was one of the biggest warmongers, in my opinion, that's ever been in the U.S. Senate, who finally passed away. But as he passed away, he has just formed one of the harshest sanctions against Russia again. And then Trump said, oh, we're going to pass it in honor of him. So Trump had just the day before said he talked with Putin on the phone and had a progressive conversation. So what's going on with the back and forth with the endless wars and the sanctioning and sanctions? Not, you know, it's not a diplomatic tool. It's a object of war, actually.
I mean, I would argue that paradoxically, because life is paradox, sanctions have helped Russia, have turned Russia from a tertiary power to a global power.
Cannot agree more. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
For many, many reasons. But you go to Moscow and you're like, wait, we've destroyed Russia? I don't think we have. We've helped Russia. Yeah. So, why is Trump going along? It's because he is a slave to the neocon war lobby, obviously, and they want this. There's no organic movement in the United States to have a war with Russia. It's so insane. It's so divorced from Americans' concerns that this is a tiny group of highly motivated people whose motives are not entirely clear, but they're dark motives, they're evil motives, trying to have this war. And I think we're going to get this war. If someone doesn't slow this down right away, you know, 2030? No. I think it's imminent. I'm upset about it, because it's like, once again, you look back on the First and Second World Wars and you're like, well, why would Europe, Christian Europe, the most beautiful civilization man has ever created, why would it destroy itself? Like, what was that? You know, and who was pushing that? And I can't answer that question, but I know what a tragedy it was. No country lost more people than Russia, of course, in the Second World War. And here we're pushing to do it again? The whole point of all these post-war institutions, beginning with the UN, but all of them, the SWIFT system, all of them, the whole point was to prevent another world war.
Right.
And now we're moving toward another world war. And it's the same people pushing it. And it's just so important not to be intimidated and to say out loud, I know exactly what you're doing. I know who is doing it. And how about no? Because this is not your civilization. It's mine. And you're not allowed to destroy it. You can't wreck my country. You didn't build it. Stop. And so I would say that to Lindsey Graham and the rest of them. You know, I'm not attacking Lindsey now that he's passed, but like John McCain, yeah. these people are lunatics.
Yeah.
And there is a spiritual component to this. And I have to say, when Putin, here I am like talking to Putin again, I'm not, but it's just true. Yeah. Yeah. Banning witchcraft in Russia?
Yeah.
Was like the great, why can't we ban witchcraft? Like, I don't know. That seems like a pretty obvious thing to do. No, you can't worship demons in my country because it could destroy my country. But, you know, we would never do that because the witchcraft lobby is pretty strong in the United States, turns out.
Tucker, but from what we know, Marco Rubio is about to meet Minister Lavrov just tomorrow. So there is some negotiation going on. But do you think that putting this pressure and new packages of sanctions on Russia, Trump still has a chance to broker some sort of a deal with Ukraine that he was aiming at? Or is this chance completely lost?
I don't think there is, no. I mean, I hope that, I pray there is, and I certainly don't want to discourage people or make them feel hopeless, but in order to bring a peace in Ukraine, the United States government would have to stand up to the neocon war lobby and say, you're not in charge. What are you doing? How does this help us? It hurts us. I mean, Trump said 10 years ago, if we continue this conflict with Russia, we're going to drive Russia to China. They won't have a choice. I don't think Russia wants to be allied with China, but if they were ever allied, Trump said, here you would have the world's largest country, biggest landmass with the most resources in a partnership with the world's largest population and the world's largest economy. And together, that is hegemony. Like, they run the world at that point, and we don't.
That's
so don't
what
do
was,
that.
Zbigniew Brzezinski was warning about, you remember?
Yeah.
Exactly
of
about
course.
That.
Of course. It's the most obvious mm-hmm. thing ever. So if you're pushing for war with Russia as an American, you're trying to destroy the United States. It's that mm-hmm. simple. And it's not about who's Churchill and who's Chamberlain and all this nonsense that they, you know, idiots like Biden are always talking about. Marco Rubio's talking about. Look, the truth is you can't make a case for war with Russia. We are at war with, the U.S. is at war with Russia. CIA is targeting attacks in mainland Russia. We are at war with Russia. I grieve saying that. It's so crazy. It's so reckless. It's so destructive. And I'm so embarrassed. But we are. And we would have to say to all the people who fund Marco Rubio's campaigns for the last 30 years, I'm sorry, you're not in charge. And there's no appetite to do that. I've tried to do it. You know, they don't like it when you do that. But tough. Mm-hmm. Who puts you in charge anyway? Like, what is this?
The backed with Russophobia, you made some good points about how the narrative is really trying to make Russia seem like the villain, the enemy, the bad. And as you know, you met me here the last time we met. We were talking in Moscow, and I came here seeking political asylum when the Biden administration weaponized against me. And I was safer and freer in Russia. And one of the things that people keep saying to me is, well, you don't have free speech. Well, I have to say, I have more free speech than some of my American colleagues or friends in England. George Galloway was just detained under the anti-terrorism in UK. An American who has no ties with UK was just detained, Dan Kovalik, a law professor, for his pro-Russia position. So where's free speech in all of this? So America claims to be a democracy, talks about free speech, but then they ban RT, which Roger Waters brought up on your show just recently, and how it's banned in Europe and in America. And so you can't hear the Russian perspective unless you're listening to independent media. So they're kind of weaponizing Russophobia against people to where they can't even talk about it. You can't even tell the truth about how beautiful it is here. I've now lived here a couple of years. It's very much thriving. Young people are able to get businesses. They're able to own flats. My daughter is out of college, and it's been a struggle for her and her husband. They both work full time, but they can't buy a house yet. And I don't know when they can in America, right? So anyway, I'll let you talk about
it. I couldn't agree more. I mean, you can bottom line it. In the last 12 months in Russia and the UK, what government has arrested more of its own citizens for posting something on social media that the government didn't like? Well, right. In the UK, it's 3-1. Yeah. Three times as many Britons, which has a smaller population than Russia, have been arrested for naughty Facebook posts than Russians. So it's not even a debate. Like, mm-hmm. it just comes down to that. What country arrests more people for free speech violations? UK.
Yeah.
So, look, here's my perspective. It's really simple, and it's never changed. I'm pro-American. My ancestors helped found this country. I love this country. They're all buried here. I'm going to be buried here. I'm not leaving. I think I'm patriotic. But what I believe in is the country that I grew up in, or thought I grew up in, which is a country that guaranteed absolutely, in the first line of its founding documents, the right of every American citizen to speak his conscience, to say what you think is true. And there's absolutely no way I'm going to allow that to be taken from me. I mean, I'll face any penalty in the defense of that. Why wouldn't I? That's my birthright. I'm an American. And people say, oh, America's exceptional and it's so different from every other place. Well, not really, except on that question. Free speech is the first right our government exists to protect, to guarantee. It's a right given us by God. That's our belief. We didn't get it from the government. Congress didn't pass a law saying we get to say what we think is true. God gave us that right as human beings, and our government exists. It's here to protect that right. So no, I'm never going to bow to that. That is the foundational right of this country. So yes, and of course, can I say one last thing? The reason it's the first right guaranteed is because it's the first freedom tyranny eliminates. It's the first thing that tyrants get rid of. They don't want to be criticized. Words are far more important than bullets or missiles. Changing people's minds, bombing people rarely changes their minds in the way that you expect it will. Saying the truth out loud changes the world. Jesus did it. And many in the subsequent 2,000 years have changed the world by saying the truth out loud. So they don't want they don't care about lies. You can lie all you want. The second you say something true, boy, they try and shut you down. But, you know, it's incumbent on us to be brave and just keep going. It's like, okay, you don't like it. Sorry.
Yeah.
Tucker, but since you mentioned your visit to Russia, as a Russian, may I please ask you, because I'm meeting a lot of foreigners here in Russia, and most of those visiting Russia for the first time are usually very much surprised, because what they see with their own eyes here in Russia is usually very much different from the way it is portrayed in Western media. So can I ask you about your personal impression? What surprised you most when you came to Russia? I know you've been here twice, so what surprised you most?
Yeah, and I was going to go there again. I was supposed to go there this winter, but I mean, it's gotten so complicated. I mean, the Russians were great. They gave me a visa and I was on my way, but you know, you're heavily discouraged from doing that as an American, heavily. As you know, and people are arrested on the way back. So yeah, I mean, I was shocked by it. I've said this many times. I was shocked by it. I've always loved Russian literature. I studied the Soviet period in college, so I knew something about Russia, but not really. I knew nothing about contemporary Russia. My father had been there a lot during the Soviet period and the right after the fall of communism and had said, boy, that's a poor country. That was sort of all I knew about it. And it's not a poor country. It's the opposite. It's a lot. I mean, it's an amazing country. It's a beautiful country. And I went from Moscow to Siberia. I saw a lot of it. And I thought it was remarkable and interesting. And I thought the people were so well-educated and smart. I mean, there's a reason they dominate world chess. So, no, I was completely impressed by Russia. By the way, it's Russian. It's not American. So I don't live there. It's not my culture. It's not my language. It's not my history and not my people. So I'm not, you know, moving there. But as an American, a total outsider who does not speak Russian, I thought it was just absolutely wonderful. It's my favorite country I've ever visited by far.
Wow,
I loved
thank
it.
Thank you. Thank
and
you.
And I felt, I did, I lo- well, I did. And by the way, I shouldn't, why should I feel shame saying that? And
you
in
shouldn't.
The night, I was at a dinner party in the UK 2 weeks ago with some very smart people who I love. And this one person was saying, they were talking about Russia. And I said, man, you guys should be really careful. You know, they're going to smack you with hypersonic weapons if you don't slow down. Oh, that would never happen. Oh, I think it definitely would. I mean, you're blowing up people in Russia. Like, at some point, they're going to hit you, and they're going to win. So stop this. And this person looks at me and goes, well, the thing about Russia is, in Russia, you know, it's such a totalitarian system that the people are just suffering, like they're totally impoverished, but they're so afraid of Putin that they just have to keep going along with this war. And I said, you think the people in Russia are impoverished? I was like, yeah. I said, have you been there? I said, this person said, no, but, you know, I read about it. I was like, look, I'm not an expert on Russia, but I've been there a couple times. Moscow is way nicer than London. Are you aware? It's also bigger than London. Did you know that? What? And they looked at me like I was like a Russian agent or something. I was here to spy on them for Putin or something. I was like, no. I'm an American. I'm just telling you, I've been there. And it's way nicer than London.
Safer, much safer.
And they stopped talking. And of course it's safer. And they look at me like, you're dangerous. Like they couldn't deal with it. And I thought, oh, how sad. And these are very rational, smart people, decent people who I agree with on most things. Mm-hmm. but they've been so propagandized. The propaganda in the West on this and some other questions is so intense. You know, every Westerner knows being gay is great. You know, like, it's just awesome. More sodomy is better. And Russia is evil. Those are like the two things that you learn. Now, you know, it's okay to think those things, but like, you live in a world, if you live in the West, where you don't meet a single person who doesn't think that. And you're like, wait, I think I live in this like weird biosphere where no information gets in that challenges the narrative. And that's not good at all. It's bad.
Yeah, you know, this attempt to cancel Russia, they're so weird, I mean, for us. I mean, canceling Dostoevsky, for example, or Tchaikovsky, or Tolstoy. I mean, whom are you punishing, guys? You know, if your ballet dancers in America, for example, or in Europe, cannot perform in the Nutcracker or in the Swan Lake, I mean, who would be deprived of the masterpieces of global cultural heritage? Definitely not the Russians.
It's so ugly and ignorant. And as someone who loves Tolstoy and loves Dostoevsky, but particularly Tolstoy, I mean, I could go on about Tolstoy, but like, if you're banning Anna Karenina, you're a savage. Like, that's savage. Yeah. First of all, we're against book burning. That was one of the main lessons of the Second World War. In my childhood, we're against genocide, we're against book burning. That's what we learned from the Nazi period. And all of a sudden you wake up and we're like, no, genocide's totally fine as long as Israel's doing it. In fact, it's not genocide. In fact, if you call it genocide, you're the bad person. What? No. The person committing genocide is the bad person. I'm against it. I'm against genocide. That's what I was taught growing up. The Holocaust is bad. Yeah, I totally agree. So, and then book burning was like, that was just a Nazi thing to do. You can't ban books. We're banning books. Amazon bans books. It's like... I'm not okay with that. I actually believed what I learned as a child in the United States, that totalitarian behavior is evil. It's an offense against God because our rights are granted us by God. I was taught that. The Nazis are bad because they treated people as subhumans and they murdered entire populations. Okay, I've never moved on from that and I never will.
I agree with what you're saying. And being here in Russia, and I have no, by the way, I'm not Russian at all. My family's Irish and English, whatever. And I've been welcomed here. I'm safe here. There's no crime. When I go to the park, I don't have to worry about anything being stolen. There's not homeless people or druggies. There's not all of that. You see teenagers and families enjoying themselves. It's a very wonderful environment.
Yeah, at 4 a.m., you can walk at night safely in the street. Nothing will happen.
And you have brought this up because there is cameras. And people mentioned, well, you're in a surveillance state. But it's safe here, and the crimes are very low. You just recently did a show on flock cameras and what's happening in America, and you made a really good point about flock cameras. All those flock cameras, but the crime statistics are remaining the same in the cities, and it's still very dangerous. Yeah. What is happening
so
with
crime
that?
Itself is optional. I mean, crime itself is optional. You don't have to have crime.
Yeah.
I mean, you will always have human sin because people are sinful, me included. You know, they'll always, plot to do bad things or take shortcuts or whatever. But like violent crime in your cities, people ODing on drugs on the sidewalk, people using public parks as a restroom. Like, no, you only have that because your leaders want it. And our leaders do want it. And so you have to ask, like, why is that? You could fix that in a day. How about no? Like, I've got four kids. None of them ever smoke pot at the breakfast table. I don't know if they smoke pot or not, but they didn't do it in my house because I would just say, no, we're not doing that. Like, I'm dad and we're not doing that. And they'd be like, okay, we're not doing that. And so our leaders could just say, no, we're not going to rape old women and we're not going to spray paint buildings and we're not going to sell drugs in public. Probably never get rid of all drugs, but we can definitely get rid of open air drug markets in one day. Because how about no? And so again, we have these things because our leaders want them. It's not just Russia. There are plenty of countries around the world where there's just no crime like that. There may be deep financial crimes you can't see, maybe parts of the economy run by a mafia. That's very common, Japan, for example. But Japan has no crime. The Gulf has no crime, zero crime. You can leave your car with the keys in it, and people do. And so, again, we live in a chaotic, dangerous society because our leaders want us to live in a chaotic and dangerous society. And then the question becomes, well, why would they want that? And that's very dark. And that's why we should ban witchcraft right away in the United States, in my opinion.
Tucker, if I may ask you, how would you call this period of time we're living in? For example, if 10 years later we look back, you know, at these years, how would you call it? Would you call it a new Cold War? Or maybe you think we're already in the ongoing Third World War? How would you call this period of time?
Well, it's so hard. That's such a smart question, and it's hard to know. And this is something that we talk about a lot at our dinner table, and I think about a lot. It's famously difficult to understand the contours of something when you're too close to it. It's the famous, you know, the right. elephant in a dark room. I can feel this giant thing. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
So we're right in the middle of this, but we know this. All big changes in human history are a result of one question: who has the power?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're seeing the end of the post-war order dominated by the United States. And you're seeing a movement of power, mostly economic power, east. And I don't want this. I love the United States. I'd like the United States to run the world and do a good and humane job of it. We haven't, unfortunately, but I'm not in charge. What we're seeing now is a movement of power and of population and military power, economic power, power. The ability, power being the ability to change the course of events. And we're seeing that movement from west to east. And I'm not convinced it'll be a better world, by the way. Mm-hmm. I'm a Christian. I would like to see Christian nations and the Christian sensibility dominate the world. But again, I'm not in charge. So that's what we're seeing. And, you know, at some point, I would think fairly soon, this is moving because of technology, everything moves mm-hmm. more quickly. I would think in my lifetime, we will see a public acknowledgement by everybody that you know, other people are in charge. And so what you're seeing now is a scramble over power.
Mm-hmm.
It's a scramble. You know, everyone can feel this is happening. This is a historic pivot. Like, everything is changing really, really fast, and every big trend is part of it, including AI and drones, and every big technological development is connected to this shift in power. And, you know, there's always turmoil when power changes hands, right? I mean, it's always turmoil. When, you know, your mom gets divorced, your dad leaves and a stepdad comes in, it's a rocky period. And hopefully, you know, you get along with the stepdad and, like, everything's fine. But there is a period where everything is kind of up in the air. A lot of questions are unsettled. And
I think the problem is that the United States are not going to recognize it. That's the
problem.
Well,
yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of discussion about the multipolar world. And I was at an event in Kazan with BRICS, which I'm sure you've heard of, and the BRICS Nations meeting, and India is part of that. And I think, you know, when you think about a country like India, they're sick of being bullied. Like, for instance, being told they can't buy oil and gas from Russia, and the West and America is telling them, no, you can't do that. I mean, what is your thoughts on the way, I mean, I know you said you were hoping that America would be in control, but what about a multipolar world where everyone's respectful of sovereign nations and maybe the smaller nations have a voice as well, particularly now that AI is coming forward and such. But what are your thoughts about BRICS and the multipolar world?
So global power is a function of, it is a product of resources and technology. And that has always been true. So the country with the most resources and the dominant technology is in charge. So let's just start there. Okay. So the United States has lost its advantage in both. And so the United States is not going to run the world unchallenged. And so my view for a number of years, and I've said it many times in public and been attacked for it, is that think through how to retreat a little bit, not entirely. I think the United States has a lot to offer the world and a lot of important technology and, of course, a lot of resources and a lot of smart people. But you can't have military bases in the Philippines and Japan, and you can't control the East because China has a bigger economy than you. And China would like to control its region. I mean, I don't know why that's weird. The South China Sea is in China's sphere of influence. So what you need is a rational power-sharing agreement with emergent countries like China, primarily China, but also India, where you say, in the Gulf states, where you say, okay, you know, we can't be in charge of your region anymore, but how do we kind of keep global trade going? Like, how do we keep the good things and shift, you know, give you back the power that, by the way, by rights you deserve? And the United States brings its focus back into its hemisphere, particularly to Canada, which is the richest country in the world. The proportion of resources to population in Canada is the highest in the world. It's the richest country. and it's, we've got the longest border in the world with Canada. It's our biggest trading partner. So like, maybe we should spend some time thinking about Canada and Mexico, which is a source of so many of our problems because of the drug cartels and migration. And like, why don't we do that? Mm-hmm. Like, what are we doing here? Why do we have all these bases in the Middle East? Why do we have bases in Bahrain? Like, what is this? It's crazy. And so that's been my argument for years. And they'll look at you and be like, oh, you hate America. It's like, no, I love America. I don't want to see it destroyed by overextension, by hubris, by the things that destroy nations. And unfortunately, the people in charge are so stupid and so selfish and in some cases so evil that they can't face reality. There's no sense of like physical reality. Like, let's go invade an island in Iran because that's going to open up the Strait of Hormuz. And it's like, how are we going to do that? Can we get an aircraft? We can't even get our aircraft carriers within artillery range of Iran. Like, we can't actually do that. But there's no acknowledgement in our leadership class of the limits of power. And, you know, that's a recipe for disaster, in my opinion.
Tucker, if I may ask you, you are probably the most well-known journalist in the world today. We are not yet, but trying to get there as well. Was there a moment of time when you realized that what you are doing is not in vain, that you can really change something, that you can raise awareness of certain people and they can bring it to decision makers? Was there some moment of time like that?
Well, I had just the opposite experience, unfortunately, where I convinced myself that I could change things or stop this war with Iran. And I couldn't. I didn't have the power. You know, I kind of lied to myself. In fact, I was just attacking American policymakers for not understanding the limits of their power. I didn't understand the limits of mine. And I really thought that just by talking with words, no army, but just words, I could stop Trump from invading Iran. And I couldn't. So I was sad about that. But I was also glad to know my own limits.
I know you're coming up on your 35th anniversary. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
To you and your wife, Susie.
Thank you.
That's so beautiful. And
so
please
sweet.
Wish her well and give her my love. She's someone I would
Thank
want
you.
To meet. What is your perfect day? What is Tucker's perfect day when you don't have a cold?
My perfect day? You know, most of my days are the same. I mean, our children are all grown. Three are married. And so we live with our dogs, and we really enjoy it. I mean, I get up early. I start my sauna fire, and I read the Bible early in the morning, drink my coffee with my dogs. And then I sit in my kitchen with my wife and talk for an hour or so. Then I go to work. I go to my barn where I am now. Or I go into the woods with my dogs or my kids. And I don't know. I have to say, like, for all the disaster, and I remind myself of this. I try to remind myself of this a lot. If you zoom out on the world, you see this picture of chaos and division and violence, which I hate. But if you think about how you actually live, and it's not because I'm so rich. I'm not. First of all, I'm not so rich. And second, I don't live like a rich person. Ask anyone who knows me. But I live surrounded by nature and people I love and dogs. I really love animals so passionately. So that brings me real joy every single day. So it's important for me to remind myself, if I spend my life thinking about how Russia's going to send, you know, hypersonic missiles into Britain where I have family, and the Britons are going to like try and fight a war against Russia and get killed, like, it makes me so sad. But I can't control that. What I can control is how I treat other people and how I get along with my wife and my children and my friends, the people who work for me and my dogs. And all of those relationships are so happy. Like, they literally are all so happy. I don't have a single broken relationship in my personal life. And that's what matters. That actually matters to me anyway. It's where all my happiness comes from. So when I force myself to get off social media, the poison of social media, and assess my own life, I'm content, I'm joyful, I'm grateful.
Well, we were joyful to have you. So thank you
for
all your wisdom.
We're so happy to have you on our show. Thank you so much. And thank you also for delivering truth, whatever it takes.
And come to Moscow again.
I hope I see you in Moscow. Oh,
yeah.
Man. If I can just say one last thing, your restaurants are so unbelievable. I just like the food. That's part of it also. And I like the churches. But the black bread, and you think Russian black bread, which I've read about my entire life and never had it, because it's a staple in Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, who I grew up reading, you know, that everyone's eating black bread all the time. I thought black bread was sweet, like raisin bread, but it's got this incredibly interesting sour kind of fermented taste,
malt,
which is even better.
It is fermented, yeah.
Yeah, like a malty
malt
taste.
Malt, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's like non-alcoholic beer. It's just the most interesting thing I've ever eaten. I could live on it. Anyway, I'll see you there.
Yeah.
Okay, see you here in our studio next time you come to Moscow.
Yes, bye.
Thank you, ladies.
Really great to be with you. Feel
thank
better.
You. Thank you.
Thank you, Tucker. You see, we're trying to bring best guests for you. So stay with us and let's make world better together.
Yes, please subscribe. Also subscribe to Tucker Carlson and his channel. Independent media needs your help if you want to keep getting the truth. Take care, everyone. We'll
Take
see
care.
You next time.